Good morning and welcome to Flight Logic Brief. It's Monday, May 11th, 2026, and I'm Alex.
And I'm Sam. We've got a heavy show today, Alex.
We do. Fuel supply crisis hitting business aviation. A fatal business jet crash in Maine. The National Transportation Safety Board opening a probe into that frontier evacuation in Denver. Gulfstream rolling out a brand new airplane. And Boeing's history of self-inflicted wounds getting another deep dive from Liam News.
Plus, we've got Bond Aviation showing up out of nowhere with a $1.7 billion jet order. I want to get to that one.
Yeah, we'll get there. But Sam, I think we have to start with the fuel story. This is the one operators are actually waking up worried about.
Agreed. This is the one.
So this is reporting out of the Aero Friedrichshafen show in Germany, by way of Aviation International News on YouTube. Private jet operators are facing potential fuel shortages directly tied to the Iran war and the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Jet A supplies are at risk of becoming severely restricted in the coming weeks.
Right, and the Strait of Hormuz, just to ground this for anyone who hasn't been tracking it closely, that's the choke point at the mouth of the Persian Gulf. Roughly a fifth of global oil moves through there. When that closes, the whole crude supply chain reorganizes overnight.
And the knock-on effect to Jet A specifically is what's interesting here, because business aviation?
Business aviation is at the back of the line. That's the whole point. When supply tightens, refiners and distributors prioritize the airlines first because of contracted lift agreements, government and military second, and corporate and fractional Jet A allocations get squeezed last.
So if you're a Part 91 flight department or a Part 135 charter operator,
you need to be on the phone with your fuel provider this week, not next week. Lock in your contract volumes, find out what your allocation actually looks like if posted pricing goes sideways, and start mapping out alternate fuel stops along your typical routes.
And Ryanair's Michael O'Leary, this is from a simple flying piece we'll get to. He's been warning that European airlines could go bankrupt this summer if fuel stays at $1.50 a barrel.
Which tells you something about how the airlines are reading it. If O'Leary is sounding the alarm, this isn't speculative. This is real.
Speaking of which, the Aero Friedrichshafen show itself, biggest business aviation presence ever this year. Static displays packed with jets, turboprops, helicopters.
And against that backdrop, you've got operators on the show floor literally having sidebar conversations about fuel allocation. That's the split screen of business aviation right now. Record showroom, fragile supply chain.
Textron showed off a passenger-carrying version of the Cessna Sky Courier at the show. Up to 19 passengers can operate off unprepared gravel and grass strips.
That's a significant pivot. The Sky Courier launched as a freighter for FedEx feeder operations. Putting 19 seats in it opens up regional, commuter, island-hopping, remote community access work that the Caravan can't do at that capacity.
And it's still a Pratt & Whitney PT6-powered twin turboprop, so the maintenance ecosystem is already there.
Right. Operators love that. You don't need to retrain your line crew on something exotic.
Horizon Aircraft was also there with the Cavorite X7. This is a Canadian startup doing a hybrid electric vertical takeoff design with fans actually embedded inside the wings.
That's a different architecture than what most of the eVTOL crowd is doing. Joby, Archer, those guys are all running tilt rotors or open propellers. Horizon's putting the lift fans inside the wing structure itself, then using a PT6 pusher for forward flight.
And the claim is better cruise efficiency because once you're in forward flight, the wing is clean.
The aerodynamic case is interesting. Whether the certification case holds up is a separate question. Embedded lift fans are mechanically complex, and you've got to certify a redundancy architecture that satisfies the Federal Aviation Administration. That's not trivial.
Rolls-Royce was there too, pushing Corporate Care Enhanced, which is their premium engine maintenance program.
That product matters more than people realize. Asset value preservation on a corporate jet is enormously tied to engine program enrollment at resale. If you're not on a program, you can lose seven figures off the back end of a sale on a large cabin aircraft.
Now let's talk about the heavier stuff on the YouTube side. There's a string of accident analysis videos this week that are worth pulling out, but I want to flag the most operationally relevant one first. The F-15E Strike Eagle shootdown in Iran.
Yeah, two former Strike Eagle pilots, including the one who goes by Hoover, broke this down. First combat loss of an F-15E to enemy fire since operations began. Pilot was recovered. The weapons systems officer is still missing as of recording.
The aircraft was apparently out of RAF Lakenheath 48th Fighter Wing.
And that's significant because it tells you something about how the air campaign is being prosecuted and what Iranian integrated air defenses are now capable of. The Strike Eagle isn't a stealth platform. It's relying on standoff weapons, electronic warfare, and tactics. If they're getting a kill on an Eagle, the threat environment has shifted.
Then on the general aviation accident analysis side, there's a cluster of videos that keep hitting the same theme. Get there-itis. Pilots ignoring weather. Pilots flying without the recency or the qualifications.
The Greg Biffle citation, 550 crash near Statesville, North Carolina. The NTSB preliminary is out. Pilot held a type rating with a limitation requiring a qualified second in command, and he was operating single pilot.
That's a willful limitation violation.
That's exactly what it is. And when something goes wrong, that limitation becomes the entire story.
And there's another one, the French Valley Airport crash. The Cessna 550 Citation II that went down 800 feet short of the runway near Murrieta, California on a Vegas departure. Two commercial pilots, four passengers, all six killed.
That one circled back through fatigue, circadian disruption, possible night into marginal weather approach issues. Vegas late night, departure in the small hours, approach into French Valley, which doesn't have the kind of approach lighting you'd want at O-Dark 30.
The lesson for our audience. If you're flying a single pilot certified jet under Part 91, you are the entire safety system.
And you have to act like it. Crew rest, weather minimums, approach minimums, all of it.
Captain Joe put up a piece this week on the Federal Aviation Administration's new U.S. Agent for Service rule. This one is going to affect a lot of our international audience.
Right. This is 14 CFR Part 3, Subpart C. It requires anyone holding an FAA certificate with a foreign address, pilots, mechanics, dispatchers, remote pilots, to designate a U.S.-based agent to receive and forward official correspondence.
And we're talking about an estimated population of over 100,000 certificate holders.
If you've got an FAA certificate and you live overseas, you need to deal with this. Designate an agent, get the paperwork in, because the consequences for failing to comply can ultimately involve certificate action.
Captain Joe also did pieces on EASA to FAA conversion and FAA to EASA conversion. The 2 EASA path is the harder one, up to 13 theoretical exams, medical, English proficiency, flight training at an ESA-approved organization, and a check ride.
That's a real commitment. We're talking months and tens of thousands of dollars depending on the rating. The other direction is more streamlined, but still 8 steps with a check ride.
And there's a Captain Joe piece on motion sickness in pilots that's worth mentioning briefly because it comes up more than people admit.
It does, especially during instrument training, where you're head down in the panel for long stretches in turbulence. The mitigation isn't complicated. Ventilation, horizon focus when possible, hydration, ginger, and acclimatization through repeated exposure. But the willingness to admit you're getting nauseous is the bigger barrier.
So switching gears, the simple flying coverage of the Frontier evacuation at Denver, which is now a formal National Transportation Safety Board investigation.
And the framing here is important. This wasn't your typical evacuation. The Airbus A321neo on Frontier Flight 4345 May 8th struck a runway trespasser. The body was partially ingested into the engine.
That alone is horrific.
And then on top of that, the evacuation itself is what the NTSB is now zeroing in on, because passengers were bringing carry-ons off the airplane.
Which we have talked about on this show, what, 3 times in the last 6 months?
Because it keeps happening. The carry-on culture is now an active safety hazard. The Federal Aviation Administration's evacuation certification standard is 90 seconds with half the exits blocked. Every bag a passenger brings down the slide blows that standard.
And the NTSB is finally going to investigate this as a behavioral and systemic safety problem, not just an after-action footnote.
And I think that's good, because the airlines have tried PSAs, they've tried flight attendant briefings, they've tried signage, nothing has moved the needle. So now we may see a recommendation that puts real teeth into it.
Maybe physical bag stowage during taxi. Maybe seat back retention during critical phases of flight.
That's where I think this goes. The European Union Aviation Safety Agency has been ahead of the FAA on this conceptually for a few years.
Other pieces from simple flying. Alaska Airlines now operates 10 routes that exceed 8 hours, with Seattle to Incheon as their longest at 11 hours 55 minutes westbound on the 787-9.
That's the post-Hawaiian acquisition strategy materializing. Alaska is now a legitimate long-haul carrier. They are no longer regional.
And the 787-9 is the vehicle that makes that math work.
Range, fuel burn, 2 pilots up front, twin engine over water reliability, it checks every box.
Simple flying also did a Boeing 737X versus 777-300ER comparison. The 777-9 matches the 300ER's range of about 73-70 nautical miles, but carries more passengers. The 7778 stretches range past 8,700 nautical miles for the ultra-long-haul mission.
And that 7778 is the airplane that will displace some of what the A350-1000 currently does, plus open up routes that aren't economically viable today, Sydney to London nonstop in particular.
And the GE9X engine is the only power plant that can move that airframe. 134-inch composite fan, up to 134,300 pounds of thrust. Boeing built the airplane around the engine.
Which is unusual. Historically, Boeing offers engine choice on most of its programs. The 777-300ER had GE, Pratt, and Rolls options early before it standardized on GE. The 777X is GE only by design.
The acoustic comparison piece is interesting too. The Airbus A220 is roughly 18 decibels quieter than the 737 MAX at takeoff.
18 decibels is enormous. That's perceived as roughly 3 to 4 times quieter to the human ear. And that matters for airports with strict noise abatement curfews, London City, Orange County, Washington National.
The Pratt & Whitney PW1500G geared turbofan, that's the difference.
The geared architecture lets the fan turn slower while the core runs at optimal speed. That's where the noise reduction comes from. The 737 MAX is using the CFM LEAP, which is a great engine, but it's still a direct drive architecture.
The NBA private jet story is fun. The league standardized on a fleet of Airbus A321neos operated by Delta with Comlux VIP interiors, replacing aging 747 charters. 28 teams accepted. The Dallas Mavericks and Houston Rockets refused.
Of course they did.
Why does that not surprise you?
Because Mark Cuban famously had his own 767 for the Mavs for years. The Rockets have their own arrangements through ownership. These are not franchises that want to be told what to fly on.
And Simple Flying also recapped the Royal Air Force A400M humanitarian airdrop to Tristan da Cunha for the suspected hantavirus case. 6 paratroopers, 2 clinicians, parachuted into the most remote inhabited island on the planet.
4,200 miles from RAF Brize Norton, with a stop at Ascension Island for support. First humanitarian parachute mission in RAF history. That's a significant capability demonstration.
And Simple Flying noted the massive U.S. airport expansion programs. JFK at $19 billion, Dallas, multiple hubs.
Which on one hand is great for capacity. On the other hand, you've got NOTAM stacks at these construction-heavy airports that read like novels. Pay attention to your taxi diagrams. The closures are real and they change daily.
Let's move to business aviation. Several big stories from the Google News feed, and Sam, I want to start with the worst one. The fatal business jet crash in Maine.
6 people killed, business jet attempting a takeoff in a snowstorm. That's all we have on the public details so far.
And without more, we have to be careful. But the broad operational picture is clear enough.
Contaminated runway, performance calculations, go, no-go, decision-making, and winter operations. These are the questions the NTSB is going to be asking. Was the runway swept? Was the airplane de-iced? What was the takeoff data calculated against?
This is a recurring failure mode in business aviation. Winter operations, departure pressure, pilot wants to get the principal home. Runway looks okay from the cockpit, but isn't.
And the data on contaminated runway takeoffs is brutal. Slush in particular can extend your takeoff roll by 50% or more. If you didn't do the math, you didn't have the runway. That's the whole thing.
For every flight department listening, this is your reminder to dust off your contaminated runway procedures and rebrief them.
Even if you think you know them. Especially if you think you know them.
On the lighter side of the news, Gulfstream took the wraps off the G300. This is their formal entry into the super midsize segment.
And that segment is dominated right now by the Praetor 600, the Citation Latitude and Longitude, and the Challenger 350. So Gulfstream is walking into a fight.
But it's Gulfstream. They walk into a fight with a brand premium nobody else has.
That's true. The buyer who wants a Gulfstream wants a Gulfstream. The question is whether they can hit the price point that segment actually demands. Super midsize buyers are price sensitive. They are not buying a G700.
And speaking of the Praetor, Aviation Week did a video piece on the new Embraer Praetor 600E, the seats specifically.
This is interesting because Embraer designed, engineered, and FAA certified their seat frame in-house. That's not a small thing. Most business jet OEMs source seats from a small handful of specialist suppliers, Yakabuchi, BE Aerospace, that ecosystem.
And Embraer is saying, no, we want to control this end-to-end.
Right, because cabin experience is now the differentiator. The avionics suites are all similar. The performance numbers are all similar. The cabin is where you win.
The Praetor 600E is targeting first quarter 2029 entry into service,
which gives them runway to refine the certification work and the supplier relationships. But Embraer is signaling they want to be vertically integrated on the experience layer of business aviation, not just the airframe.
Now the other big business aviation story. Bond Aviation Group has placed a $1.7 billion business jet order, and they are entering the fractional ownership market.
Out of nowhere, this is one of the biggest single capital commitments in business aviation in recent memory.
And the fractional market is dominated by NetJets, Flexjet, and Vista Global. Bond is walking into a very mature, very competitive segment.
And they are doing it with $1.7 billion in announced commitments, which suggests they have institutional backing. This isn't a couple of private investors and a hope. Somebody's underwriting this at scale.
What's the business case to enter fractional in 2026?
The case is that demand is still outrunning capacity in the high-end fractional space. NetJets is years out on new owner intake at certain levels. Flexjet has been growing, but they're capacity constrained too. If you can stand up a fleet quickly with a good operating model, there's room.
But standing up a flight department of that scale is enormously difficult. Pilots, mechanics, dispatch, training, scheduling software, hangar capacity.
That's where most fractional startups die. Bond is going to have to either hire massive expertise out of NetJets and Flexjet, or partner with an existing operator. We'll see which way they go.
Advanced Aviation Team also launched a bespoke jet card. This is a smaller scale story, but the trend is interesting.
Jet cards continue to fragment into specialty offerings. Bespoke means they're customizing the program around the customer rather than offering tiers. That's the inverse of the NetJets model.
And ESA certified the world's fastest business jet. That's pointing at the Bombardier Global 8000, most likely, although the article doesn't name it explicitly.
European certification opens up European airspace for the type and signals to operators across the continent that the airplane is ready to deploy on transatlantic missions. That matters because the European business aviation fleet is one of the largest outside North America.
Let's get into the Liam news pieces, because Scott Hamilton has dropped a five-part series on Boeing's path to recovery, framed through the lens of change incorporation and configuration control.
And Alex, this is the most important industry analysis published this week. Anyone in commercial aviation should be reading this series.
So set the table. What is change incorporation?
Change incorporation is the process by which a manufacturer retrofits already built airplanes to match the final certified design when those airplanes were assembled before the type certificate was issued. When you push a program hard and parallel build airplanes before certification finishes, you end up with a fleet on the ground that doesn't match the type design.
And someone has to go back and physically retrofit each airplane.
And that work is enormously expensive. Liam reports that Boeing did a 30-airplane cockpit rework on the 767 historically. Supplier-driven configuration drift on the 787 caused massive financial pain. And the 700-79 is sitting in that same situation right now.
Part one of the series is the 747-400, looking back at how Boeing got change incorporation right on that program.
The 747-400 rolled out in January 88, certified January 89. New wings with winglets, two crew glass cockpit, which reduced flight deck instruments from 971 down to 365.
That's a staggering reduction.
And it represented a generational shift in flight deck philosophy. The 747-400 was where Boeing showed it could do disciplined, methodical derivative development. Hamilton's argument is that this is the standard Boeing has fallen away from.
The piece is titled Boeing's Long Arc from Disciplined Rework to Distributed Chaos.
And that's the argument in five words. Boeing went from running change incorporation as a centralized engineering discipline to outsourcing pieces of it across a distributed supplier base on programs like the 787, and the consequences are still being paid down.
What's the read for our audience as professional pilots?
For airline pilots, this is your fleet. The configuration control problems Boeing has had affect the airplanes you fly. The 737 MAX issues, the 787 production halts, the 777-9 certification delays, these all trace back to the same underlying organizational dysfunction Hamilton is documenting.
For corporate operators, it's less direct, but the supply chain pressure ripples through the whole industry.
Right. Engine availability, parts availability, MRO capacity. Boeing's troubles take oxygen out of the room.
All right, let's run through what's bubbling up in the pilot community on Reddit, because there are a few threads worth pulling on.
The Frontier evacuation thread is huge. pilots from across the industry weighing in on the carry-on culture problem we already talked about. The consensus is overwhelmingly in favor of harder rules.
And there's a thread analyzing the main business jet crash, with pilots speculating about contaminated runway performance and de-icing protocols. We won't dignify speculation, but the conversation is happening.
The transatlantic solo training debate keeps coming back. European pilots solo around 15 hours under a 45-hour curriculum. American students often solo between 30 and 100 hours.
Why is that gap so persistent?
Different regulatory structures. ESA's PPL curriculum is more prescriptive. The Federal Aviation Administration's Part 61 environment lets the CFI judge readiness, which means soloing happens when the student is genuinely ready, not when the curriculum says they should be.
Pros and cons either way.
The European argument is that early solo builds confidence and gets students to the certificate efficiently. The American argument is that we don't push students out before they're truly safe. Both are valid.
There's a thread from the pilot at 31 hours struggling with steep turns, power off stalls, and slow flight. 15 knot variations in steep turns.
That pilot needs to step back and do some chair flying. The maneuvers aren't the problem. The mental model of the maneuvers is the problem. Sit in your living room, fly the maneuver in your head, anticipate the inputs. The airplane doesn't change. Your model of the airplane has to.
There's a thread from a newly certified PPL with 7 years as an airframe and power plant mechanic with inspection authorization, asking how to break into Part 91 corporate flying.
That's a unique profile. A pilot with serious maintenance knowledge is enormously valuable in a small flight department because you can troubleshoot squawks intelligently and you understand the airplane systemically. The path is to build hours, get the multi and the instrument, and find a flight department where you can offer the dual skill set.
And the military to airline thread, the 24-year-old asking whether 8 to 10 years of Air Force or Navy is worth it.
The math has shifted on that question over the last decade. The pilot shortage has pulled civilian wages up significantly. The military pipeline is still respected and still puts you into the right seat of a major with great training. But the opportunity cost of 8 to 10 years is real.
There's a Canadian story from the RCAF accepting their first CT-137 Siskin II, which is the Pilatus PC-21 in Canadian service.
That's a major recapitalization. The PC-21 is the most modern advanced trainer turboprop in the world right now. Replaces a fleet that was getting tired. Big day for Canadian military aviation.
And the British paratrooper drop on Tristan da Cunha we mentioned earlier was the most viewed Reddit thread in the aviation community this weekend.
For good reason. It's the kind of operational story pilots love because it shows what the platforms can really do when the mission demands it.
There's a Reddit post about the Korean Air A321 crosswind go-around at an unnamed airport and the Qatar Airways go-around at Atlanta in strong winds.
Go-arounds are not failures. Go-arounds are professional behavior. The fact that they trend on social media tells you something about public misunderstanding of normal operations.
The Frontier passenger experience thread is worth flagging. 231 passengers, engine fire on takeoff, successful evacuation, no fatalities.
The crew did exactly what they were trained to do. The airplane and the people who fly it worked. The systemic issue, again, is what passengers brought down the slide with them.
And there's a thread on the ACT Airlines 747-400 freighter runway excursion at Hong Kong from last October. Two fatalities.
Final report is still coming. That accident hit close to a lot of cargo pilots because it's the kind of event that doesn't fit any single neat explanation.
A few quick ones. A Vancouver flight school question, a logbook digitization question about handling old airport identifier changes.
On that one, the answer is record the identifier that was in use at the time of the flight. Logbooks are historical documents. Don't rewrite the past.
Right. And there's a perennial flight school cost comparison between California and Texas for helicopter training, with people considering interstate relocation.
Texas is meaningfully cheaper for rotor training. If your work will let you relocate for a year, the math usually works. Fuel costs, instructor rates, aircraft rental, all lower. Just verify the school's reputation before you sign up.
All right, Sam, let's bring it home. What's the takeaway for this morning?
Three things. Talk to your fuel provider this week if you operate corporate jets, because the Strait of Hormuz situation is not abstract. Brief contaminated runway operations with your crews after the main accident. And read the Liam News series on Boeing Change Incorporation if you have 20 minutes, because it explains a lot of why your fleet looks the way it does.
And for the airline guys, the National Transportation Safety Board probe into the Frontier evacuation is going to set new precedent on carry-on behavior. Expect movement.
This is going to ripple.
That's Flight Logic Brief for Monday, May 11th, 2026. I'm Alex.
And I'm Sam. Fly safe out there. We'll see you tomorrow.